Okay, welcome to our session, Adult Refugee Entrepreneurs in Utah. So I think we all know the drill by now, so just silence your cell phones and hold questions to the end unless Jabra wants to, whatever you prefer. So about the presentation, as an educational researcher and Palestinian-American Mormon living in Utah, Naim will discuss whether Gordon B. Hinckley's criteria of friend, job, and nourishment by the word can be the basis of a formula for refugee resettlement in a new place. Can we use it in whole or in part to make newcomers to the United States feel welcome and at home? Second, how strongly does the Book of Mormon emphasize the Christian obligation to the stranger, and how pertinent is that message in the Trump era? Jabra Naim is the owner of Global Language Systems in Kaysville, Utah. He's provided language services to the military and intelligence community as well as the refugee community in Utah for the last 17 years. Between 1994 and 2001, he worked in the Middle East as editor of Arabic language editions of American technology magazines Byte, Windows, and Internet Arab World. Jabra is a proud Palestinian American whose family originates in a town in Bethlehem, Palestine. He joined the LDS Church in the Kingdom of Jordan in 1990 and was the first convert to the church there. He was Amman District President, Greece, Athens Assistant Mission President. Jabra is currently finishing a PhD dissertation on adult refugee education at BYU's McKay School of Education in the Educational Inquiry. And now for the presentation.
Thank you. I'm not used to speaking in front of microphones like that, but I'll do my best. So, thank you, Josh, for the introduction. So, this is a very big topic for me, and it's very personal for me as well. And so I thought the best way to start the presentation is to talk a little bit more about a more personal background than the bio that Josh has just read, just to establish Richie. I don't know why it stuck as Josh. That Richie has established, because it's very personal to me. So I'm Palestinian. And so for those of you who don't know what a Palestinian is or where we come from, basically I hail from the little town of Bethlehem. So it's, to me, Palestine is, you know, that whole area from the River Jordan to the Mediterranean Sea. That's my ancestral land. That's where I come from. I was born, though, in Kuwait. My father immigrated there, you know, to just work for a few years. Kuwait was, at the time, a small country. Oil was just coming up, and they were hiring lots of people, and they needed educated people. And my father spoke English, French, some Italian, you know, Arabic. He was an accountant. And, you know, so he went there looking for a better job opportunity. And the plan for him was, I'm going to go work there for a few years, save some money, go back to Bethlehem, build a house, and marry someone, and just settle down. Well, in 64, he decided to get married earlier than he planned to, and he married my mom, who is his direct maternal cousin. So my two grandmas are sisters. So she moved with him to Kuwait, and she became a migrant herself. And those were very difficult years, which are irrelevant to this, but it's sort of relevant, because when you're a migrant, you have your family with you, you share in the difficulty. In 67, the Israelis came in and occupied our town. So my dad changed from being a migrant to now being a refugee. Because once the Israelis came in, if you were living outside of the town, they immediately invalidated all your identification. And they prevented you from coming back. So all of a sudden, he couldn't go back to his town as he wanted. Before that, you know, Arabs could travel from Jerusalem all the way to Kuwait, all the way to Morocco, unhindered, basically. That we didn't have the kind of borders that the world has today. People could travel all across the Arab world very easily. So my dad and mom all of a sudden became refugees. I mean, they were a different type of refugees. They became typical kind of refugee when, you know, you're away from your country and all of a sudden your country is occupied or something happens and then you don't have a place to go back to. And I was born in Kuwait. I was born in 1968. And the year is significant because at that time the Kuwaiti borders were sort of established. They established their immigration and nationality laws. So whereas before 1968, because I was born in Kuwait, I could have become a citizen of Kuwait. You know, now the laws basically said I was born there, I'm just there on my dad's visa. So basically you grow up attached to that visa and it's not your country, but you're born there. You're familiar with the culture, you're familiar with the customs, you're familiar with the food. And so, but then even though as a child you identify with that, you identify with Kuwait as being home, it's not your home. And when you start going to school, you start having encounters with the police force, you start having encounters with, you know, paperwork that you have to do to travel, you realize all of a sudden that this is not home. In 1972, the Israelis started allowing Palestinians living abroad to come back to visit. And I was very, very young, but the experience at the Allenby Bridge, crossing from Jordan to Palestinian territory, is something that you would never forget as a child. Because you ride this bus, and this is 1972, no air-conditioned buses. You ride this bus, it's very hot, it's very humid. And I remember sitting in the back seat with my family. We're all crammed, probably like 60 people crammed in the small school bus. And we're crossing the bridge, and it's very hot. This is Jericho. So the Allenby Bridge is in southern, you know, sort of southwestern part of Jordan, southeastern part of Palestine. So you're in the Jordan Valley. It's very hot, very humid. All these people stuck in the bus together. And your bus is driving slowly across a literal bridge that crosses over the River Jordan to go to the Israeli checkpoint. And then you go down into this processing unit with thousands of other people going there to visit during the summer. And then as a child, you're strip searched. So, you know, the Israeli soldiers take you in and they have you strip naked and they fully search you. And that was my first encounter of what it means to be sort of losing home without a country. I'm going to this place that I'm going to for the first time. And, you know, I'm being subjected to this. It brought this awareness to who I am and my situation. And to be honest, you know, we went in, and every summer we'd go in with my family to, my father and mother made sure that when we could afford it, we would go back to Bethlehem and Beit Jala, which is my hometown, and we would visit. And my relationship to that place as a child and as a teenager grew up closer and closer and closer. And, you know, I started realizing who I am. You know, I'm a Palestinian. I'm living in a country that's not mine. We're sort of tied to the place. And in a typical reaction, the Kuwaiti population, which is only 600,000, and it's a country that had at the time probably a couple million people in it, started getting, even though all the immigrants there were legal, the Kuwaitis need the manpower to get oil out of those oil fields and to ship them out and all of that stuff. They were aware that they were a minority numerically in their own country, so they started restricting what immigrants can do. But they reserved their most special loathing to the Palestinians because it said on your ID, every ID in the Middle East until very recently, it said where your father was born, it told of your religion, what you were, and we were Christian. And so when you were stopped for a traffic citation or something, once you know, for traffic stop. Once they realized you're a Palestinian, you got the special treatment. And going to high school, for example, one of the most traumatic experiences for me as a child living there, or as a teenager living there, was, you know, after 7 p.m., the Kuwaiti police had a curfew, you know, where if you were a child on the street, and especially if you were a Palestinian, they chased you, they put you in this van, took you to a police station, shaved half of your head, and doused you with water, and sent you, and waited for your father to come pick you from home. So the reason I give you this background is just to show that this is a personal topic for me. Being an immigrant, being a refugee, being without a country, I'm very familiar with that. And my whole family is like that. So I have cousins who are in Russia and uncles who live in Russia. I have cousins and aunts who live in Germany. They are Germans. I have uncles and cousins living in Chile, you know, and Peru and Honduras. And, you know, recently I realized that we have cousins in Guatemala. And they are spread all over the world. And I have cousins and uncles who live here in the United States and cousins and uncles who live in Canada. So my family is all over the world. And I have a big family still living in Bethlehem. So that has its own dynamics too. And that's why when I went to do my PhD at the Department of Education at BYU, you know, I was determined that I'm going to do something about refugees. Initially, I worked with refugees here in Utah. Actually, I started working with refugees here in Utah soon after my wife and I came back here in 2002, and I started my business. I started hiring Iraqi refugees and Afghan refugees to help teach language classes as a part of my business. And so I started getting more familiar with those experiences and identifying more closely with them. So all of these things, I was determined to do something about that. I was determined to study that topic, you know, in a PhD situation. And, you know, when you go to school, especially to do graduate work, you learn more about how to think and how to analyze and how to look at things more objectively. And I wanted to look at that experience through other refugees' experiences more objectively and try to understand it better. So having given that personal context, I want to give a little bit of a historical context for the refugee issue. I mean, the refugee issue isn't something that is new to the world. We've had refugees in this world since the world started, since wars started. You know, the ancient Greeks had refuge cities. If you look in the Bible, there are rules in Deuteronomy 19 that talk about, you know, how to treat the stranger, the sojourner, the person who's lost, the person who's in distress. And, you know, in those days, in ancient times, and up till 1948, really the world did not have rules that governed how to deal with refugees. You had these sets of moral rules that governed, you know, on an ethical, moral level, how to deal with refugees, but you didn't have any legal framework that dealt with them. So what happened in 1948? What happened in 1948 was World War II ended, and the whole world sat down to evaluate, you know, that war and how to prevent it again. Because if you've studied history, you remember that World War I was the war to end all wars. That didn't turn out to be the case. Actually, World War I was the seeds of World War II. So World War II, one of the biggest things that happened was the Holocaust. So millions of Jews were killed in Europe, were murdered in Europe, whole families, whole lines. And those people, when the Nazi regime came to power, many of them had a premonition of what's to come. Those who had the financial means to escape, escaped. Those who couldn't remained in Germany, and they ended up in concentration camps and extermination camps and they were killed. And many of them tried to seek refuge in neighboring countries. Many of them tried to go to, you know, Switzerland. Many of them tried to go to England. Some succeeded, most didn't. Thousands tried to come to the U.S., but the U.S. had immigration laws that prevented those people from acting. The ships were there in New York Harbor, and they were prevented from coming down, and they were turned back to Holland, and they went back to, you know, to concentration camps, and they were exterminated. So when the world looked at that experience, they said, we have to deal with this refugee situation. What happens when, you know, there is a war situation and you have people losing their homes, who are not safe? What do we do with that? What do we do in cases where, you know, someone feels unsafe in his own country and he decides to find safety somewhere else? That's called asylum. What do we do about asylum? What do we do about, you know, the rights of these people when they are in those very vulnerable situations? So the answer was the United Nations Human Rights Charter. So the United Nations had this right, and in it, the rights of refuge were established. People have rights to be refugees. People have rights for asylum. That's in the United Nations. And so countries started joining that. There are 152 countries who have signed on it. Signed on, you know, we will provide refuge and asylum to people who need it. But there is a certain criteria that has to be met for you to be a refugee or an asylum seeker. And so what went into that was they established a special organization called the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And even though it says High Commissioner in the title, it's not just one person in charge. UNHCR is a massive organization with offices all over the world. And if you are a refugee, they are the ones who decide that. They are the ones who decide that. And there is a definition for that. You know, if you're someone who is leaving because you're feeling unsafe, because your country is unstable, you know, they decide that. They decide based on their own criteria. Now, every country, though, like the United States, for example, has its own rules, too, that go with what UNHCR says. They have their own rules. So, for example, during the 70s, the United States was involved in a very famous conflict in Vietnam. And as a result, when the United States ended up leaving Vietnam, there were hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese refugees. And the natural place for them to go to was the United States. So with those hundreds of thousands of people, 800,000 in total is what the United States ended up accepting. President Carter basically decided, okay, here is how we will deal with refugees. So the United States established its own set of laws and rules of, you know, how to accept refugees, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And in 1980, President Reagan further enhanced that rule and, you know, made it easier, made it clearer, and enhanced it. So there are distinctions that people, talking to people about the refugee issue, there are distinctions that need to be made, because especially in the current atmosphere in the United States and frankly much of the world, especially after the, you know, the events in Syria, the events in the Middle East, the events in Africa, in many parts of Africa, there is this panic all over the world about the arrival of millions of people at the border. And it is a concerning situation. You see millions of people showing up at your door. How do we know? And if you're a country like the United States, where we've had immigration and anxiety for decades, you know, about, you know, our neighbors in Mexico, those topics get confused. And we have, for example, the issue of undocumented immigrants in the United States. We have issues about people, youth who have arrived here with their families, who are staying in the country. How do we deal with that? And now we have a refugee problem, even though we are, as a country, very far away from the refugee problem. So it's very helpful when you think through these things that you think, okay, we have refugees. Refugees, becoming a refugee is a very random thing. Because you can be a refugee because, like in the Maldives, for example, the Maldive Islands, all of a sudden the ocean is swallowing, literally swallowing your land. You become a climate refugee because you lost your land. You need a place to stay. You can become a refugee. The leader of your country decides to go on a killing rampage, killing thousands of people. You're feeling unsafe and you flee. You become a refugee. You can have a situation basically where you have huge economic insecurity where you can't safely provide for your family. You become an economic refugee. So a refugee, you can, any one of us literally can become a refugee. The valley here can be hit by an, you know, 8 on Richter scale earthquake, deeming the whole place uninhabitable. We're going to have to go find refuge somewhere in Colorado or Montana or somewhere else. So you become a refugee. So a refugee is a very random thing. And people have no choice. And in the current international system, because you have 154 countries, let's say your country is unsafe for you and you leave, because it's a random thing, you can't really choose where you want to go. You can't become a refugee and say, I want to go to the United States and be a refugee there. Or I want to go to Canada. You don't have a choice. Actually, 95% of most of the world refugees are refugees in neighboring developing world countries. Because that is the safest place for them. The small percentage that ends up being in the United States or Canada or Europe is very minuscule. And it's subject to special rules. So let's say, like many of the Syrian refugees who have arrived in the United States or Iraqi refugees, you leave your country. So for a long time, many refugees are what's called inner displaced refugees. So you're a refugee in your own country. You're moving from one town to another, running away from the government or seeking better work opportunities, etc. But once you leave your country, the first thing you do is you go to a UNHCR, the Higher Commissioner for Refugees office, and you say, I am a refugee. And they have to decide. You have to go through an application process. It's a very lengthy process. It takes anywhere from 3 to 17 years. Yes, it's a very lengthy process. Only the most urgent cases end up, you know, leaving sooner than that. But you are in a refugee camp anywhere from 3 to 17 years. Or not necessarily a camp, you're in the country that, in the neighboring country that you took refuge in. And then they look at you. They look at your history. They look at your situation. They look at the source of danger to your life. And they compile a dossier of your case. And then if a decision is made you're a refugee, then you have to look amongst 154 countries and you look at where they are in their quota for refugees to decide where to send you. So many Syrian refugees, for example, ended up in Lithuania, a country that is so foreign to most Arabs, like it's like dropping someone in Alaska or something, or an Inuit village or something like that. It's so foreign to them, but many of them ended up there. Once the country is decided, then you have to go through a lengthy orientation process, you and your family, to decide, to teach you the culture, the customs, how to live there. It's a very short course. I mean, it takes about a couple of months, usually. And they try to teach you some of the language, and then they send you to the country. And then you're in the country, and the country deals with you accordingly. So that's a refugee. Now, asylum seeking is a totally different thing. because an asylum seeker usually is someone who has in mind a specific place they want to go to. So, for example, if you're someone running away from religious persecution, and I've seen this living in the Middle East, you know, there are cases where, for example, you're running away from some sort of persecution. What the authorities in that country do usually is they fabricate a criminal case against you. So they say you stole money, you hurt someone, you killed someone. They fabricate a criminal case because usually countries have agreements amongst each other to, you know, if someone has broken the law in one country, you send them back, right? So they fabricate those cases so that they can have those people back. So asylum seekers keep that in mind, and they choose the countries they go to. So it's a matter of choice. And they show up at the airport, they show up at the border, and that is very necessary for you to be an asylum seeker. You can't sneak into a country. You have to go to the borders and knock on the door, and you tell the first officer that you are an asylum seeker. You're seeking asylum in the country. And that starts a totally different process. A totally different process. So there is all of this background. So we end up with having refugees. Now, what do we do with these people? What do we do with refugees and asylum seekers? This country, and I'm going to talk about just the United States because that's what I'm most familiar and that's what I did my study and that's what I know. The biggest question is, how do we make these people comfortable? How do we make these people a part of our society? That is a big question, and it's a source of huge anxiety for most people. So you come here, well, many people's anxieties are, we don't want them to be a burden to the taxpayers. We don't want them to be, you know, criminals. We don't want them to cause instability in our communities. So there is all kinds of anxieties that people usually have about them. And so the question is, how do we deal with the people? And I was thinking about that question when I was working on my PhD. What's a framework? What's a way of thinking that help us think through this? So when I looked at the history, in the United States we had this soup and salad of terminology to deal with that. The most prominent one is the concept of assimilation. And so assimilation is one of those things that many people look at as a politically incorrect term. Because, you know, what do we do? Are we, like, trying to change who these people are to make them a part of this country, which has lots of implications? And, you know, people get offended by that. Richie and I had a conversation about this, you know, on my own PhD committee. You know, I use the term integration, which is another term to integrate people into a country, and that was offensive to some, and you know, I had to change it to something called social inclusion, which was acceptable to everyone. But basically, the idea of assimilation or integration or whatever it is you find a way to make the people have successful, what is the best way to have these people succeed, economically succeed in social life in the country that they arrive to. That's the basic idea. Some people say have them learn English, have them learn the laws and live by that, and that would be enough. That was the original idea of American assimilation. Is just learn the language, know the laws, that's all we expect from you. But, you know, as that concept grew, many people realized people have a lot more expectations from new arrivals than just learn the language and know the law. So the expectation of being economically self-reliant came in. So how do we make people economically self-reliant is now a part of this whole integration, assimilation, social inclusion formula. Well, when I was looking at all of these, I happened to think of a talk given by Gordon B. Hinckley, president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints at the time. And I thought of a talk that he gave on how do you get people into the church context. You know, how do you accept people into a church context and make them, you know, feel like this is their church and be a part of it. And his formula was you give them, you basically make sure you become friends with them, you have a job for them, like a calling in Mormon terms, and then you nourish them with the good word of God. And I thought, what if that can be generalized to refugees, to, you know, immigrants? Because refugee and migration, believe it or not, is central, like, to the Bible, for example, to spiritual literature in general, usually reserves like huge portions in it to refuge and immigration. You know, think of every story in the Bible, and there is a refugee or a migrant or an asylum seeker there somewhere. And the Book of Mormon itself is a story of migration, is a story of refuge, is a story of, you know, accepting new people. How do we make them a part of our nation? You know, there is the famous story in the Book of Mormon, for example, about the anti-Nephi Lehis. So when they get converted and they go back to live with the Nephites, the Nephites basically receive them and they give them this whole land, you know, the land of Jershon, and, you know, they have these stipulations. They basically integrate them and embrace them and add them in. So I was thinking about these things, and I thought my framework for inclusion, for integration will be, let's look at friendship, let's look at social connections that this refugee or migrant has in the new community. Let's look at how many friends he makes, what kind of relationships he has with those friends. Let's look at work. Let's look at, you know, them finding jobs, them starting jobs. When you look at the history of immigration in the United States, there are two things that jump out at you. First, new migrants, either or refugees, asylum seekers, whatever. I'm putting them now in one category just for convenience. When you arrive new to this country, one of the biggest challenges you have, even if you know English, even if you're familiar with the customs and languages, is finding work. It's working. You know, having a job. You know, there are studies that I love referring to, where researchers did 20,000 resumes. 10,000 of those, the 20,000 resumes had exactly the same qualifications. They were exactly the same resumes. But 10,000 of them had, you know, foreign names on them. They had names like Jabra Ghanem and Muhammad Ahmed and whatever on them. And the others had regular American names, John, David, Michael, James, whatever. And they sent them out. The response rate for the 10,000 resumes having foreign names on them was almost statistically zero. The response to the 10,000 that had regular names was something, and I don't remember the statistic now, it was in the area of 67% or something like that. So a huge difference. So migrants and refugees and asylum seekers always have problems with finding work. Now, the traditional path in America, and America is unique like that, and this is one of the most wonderful things about it, is that you can start your own business here. So if you look at earlier migration waves in this country in modern times, you know, mid-19th century to the present, whether it's the Chinese, whether it's the Irish, whether it's the Italians, whether, you know, the entrepreneurship and building businesses has been a core for that. Talk, for example, the Vietnamese refugees. My wife and I, you know, went and had a pedicure the other day. And, you know, it was, you know, a Vietnamese family, and very nice, very pleasant, enjoyed talking to them. And so when we left, I was talking to my wife, and I said, why is it all Vietnamese? Why is this industry dominated by the Vietnamese? So we started looking it up, And it goes back to post-Vietnam War, mid-70s, early 80s, United States. The Vietnamese were coming in, and then one of the actresses took an interest in Vietnamese refugees. And she gathered them and she said, we need to teach you a profession so that you can start your own business. What would be a thing that you'd like to do? And they talked about several professions and several things to do. And she, the actress commented that the Vietnamese women always commented on her nails and how great her nails looked. And so after a long conversation, they decided that they wanted to learn how to do nails. So this actress hired this person who taught 22 or 24 women how to be, you know, how to do pedicure and how to do nails, launched them out, and those 22 and 24 persons, because I don't know if all of them were women or not, but those 22, 24 people became the nucleus from which the pedicure industry in the United States started. And it's the same thing. When you walk into a Chinese restaurant, for example, the Chinese restaurant industry is a pure product of immigration restrictions. It was called the Asian Exclusion Act or the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, which basically limited the Chinese people from actually bringing their own families to the United States, and then it limited Asian immigration into the United States, period. And that continued until President Lyndon Johnson changed that in 1964. So almost 80 years of excluding people of a certain race from immigrating or bringing their families to the United States. But the Chinese started two industries because of that. They started the Chinese restaurant because there was a regulation that allowed them to stay in the country if they had a business. And so they started Chinese restaurants and they started ironing, because those were the only two industries, things that they could do in the country because of that. And it goes on and on. And while I was working on my dissertation, I read so many wonderful stories like that about different immigrant groups and whole industries that started because that was the only option they had. But from that whole community, you know, the Chinese community, you know, is very stable and strong in the United States because they started a business and strengthened them. So anyway, so work what is important. That's the second piece. And then, you know, nourishment of the good word of God, I decided I don't want it to be religious, but I looked at information. Information is very important in refugee and migrant communities. Having information about the country, about the area that you're living in, and, you know, how to do certain things. That's very important. But I didn't investigate that because that would have been too distracting and, you know, you're always short on time when you're doing a dissertation. So that was the start of it. That was the start of it. And then I started getting involved for my dissertation work, I started working with a small community of practice, a small community called the Spice Kitchen. They are a part of what's called the International Rescue Committee. So International Rescue Committee is an independent, you know, nonprofit corporation that deals with refugees worldwide. And what they do here in Salt Lake is they have this, it started as an experiment. If you're a refugee with culinary skills, they would take you in, ask you what you can cook, you cook it. They bring in a random group of people who sample the food, and if those people like the food, then you're in a 6-year program with the Spice Kitchen, where regardless of whether you know the language or not, they basically help you get your licensing, start marketing yourself, they help you work with your menu, and they, you know, help you eventually start your own business, whether it's a food cart or a restaurant, and you know, they just help you with that. So I started working with them, and I started focusing mostly on the entrepreneurial angle of you know, of this integration, assimilation, social inclusion work, whatever you want to call it. And it has been, you know, it validated that experience watching. I worked with 7 men and women who were from Syria, from Kenya, from there was a woman from Russia, from Bhutan, from Jamaica. Yes, Jamaica has its own refugees. I never investigated why, but Jamaica has its own refugees. So I worked with them, and you can tell that with work, when they're doing stuff, when they're interacting with people, that helps them. That makes them a part of the community. It's interesting watching things like their Facebook posts, for example, where they become, you know, very Americanized, even though they don't speak the language well. They have, you know, they have American flags on their Facebook profiles, and they speak as if they have lived here forever. Something you don't notice when you compare them to people who are not involved in activity, you know, in the community, who, you know, like in Europe, for example, there are whole communities in France and Belgium of North African Arabs who have moved to France and Belgium after, you know, French and Belgian colonialism ended in North Africa. They moved to France and Belgium because they felt they were loyal French and Belgian citizens. But unfortunately, the population of France and Belgium, you know, didn't integrate them, didn't give them opportunities for work, located them in these specific areas. They wouldn't rent them apartments. They wouldn't rent them shops. You know, total discrimination. And those communities are still having now, almost 70 years after, they are still having problems integrating in French and Belgian communities. And so the United States is really wonderful like that. Now, we have our own issues with, you know, making immigration and the whole asylum seeking and, you know, refugee process more American, if you will. You know, we have challenges with that. We have challenges in Congress, we have challenges in the White House, and we've always had challenges with immigration. Isn't specific to the current administration. I mean, all previous administrations have had challenges with immigration and refugees, all of them, you know, dating back to, you know, 1876, you know, we've had problems. So the hopeful person in me hopes that, you know, this will be resolved. But I have a fixed opinion that America is the best place to be a refugee. It is the best place to be an asylum seeker because we have freedoms that, you know, whether it is to start a business, whether it is to express yourself, you know, whether it is to be engaged in community, that do not exist in other countries of the world, including where I come from, including in the Middle East. You know, in Jordan, for example, Jordan has 3 million Syrian refugees, and they are miserable because they keep them in the refugee camps, they abuse them in the workplace, we don't have good labor laws, you know, in Jordan, and the refugees are miserable. The same thing in Lebanon. So Palestinians, so right now in the world, there is about 7 million Palestinian refugees. 7 million. Many of them still living in refugee camps. Many of them still living in refugee camps. And in those countries where they are in refugee camps, they live in miserable situations. 72 years later, they are still there, and their children are there, and children's children are there, and they are living in miserable situations. Palestinians who had refuge in the United States are prospering. The Palestinian-American community is doing great things, whether it's in Michigan and California, and especially in the Bay Area, you know, and in Washington, D.C., you know, there is a huge, vibrant Palestinian community, and it's doing great. But that's what happens. When people come here to America, they prosper. They, in all kinds of ways, not just financially. So that's my hope, is one day we will just fix this immigration situation in this country. It's too big to talk about here. So in conclusion, what can we do? I believe that the form, you know, and I get asked this question a lot. What do we do about refugees? How, if we encounter them, what do we do? First, be their friend. It is one of the things, amazing things that came out of my research is the power of friendship to make a person feel as a part of a community and thrive. Refugees especially need to know that you're their friend. And it is a difficult process to be a refugee's friend. It is very difficult because there is this language barrier. The language barrier is huge. But here is one way to get over it. If you have time, work with your refugee neighbors to teach them some English. You know, and I know, as a language teacher, I know how hard that is. But work with them on some area that would help them out. Be their friend. Second, help them find employment. We have lots of resources. Help them with their employment, whether it's working on a resume or even explaining the concept of a resume, which would be easy once you realize a resume is basically your life story. Once you've become able to communicate with a refugee or a refugee neighbor, just have them write down their resume. You know, their life story. Get to know that. You get to know them better and you get to help them do something that will help them find a job or start work. And give them information. As much information as possible, whenever possible. Make them aware of neighborhood parties, activities in the public library, places they can take the children to, places, you know, the children can play. You know, places where they can go to get health care. They need to know that information. One of the things from my experience working with refugees here is dental care. You wouldn't think dental care is a huge issue, but it is. So you can, you know, you can find dentists who do pro bono work, or you can direct, there is a couple of clinics in Salt Lake that do pro bono dental care. So you can direct them there, because many of them don't even know it exists. Because of the language barrier. So that's it. It's very, you know, it's a very good framework to think about the problem and through. So that's it. And now I just open it up, send it back to Richie, and maybe we can get some of your questions.
Well, so it looks like we have some time for questions. So if you have one, just come up and speak it in. Talking to the mic, and but I'll start out. So I was wondering if your research says much about kind of the balance between refugees maintaining elements of their own culture, but also assimilating. Because if you go too far to any extreme, it's going to lead to problems. If you focus only on assimilating and completely abandon your culture, that's going to lead to problems. But if you just try to completely live your culture and not assimilate at all, that's also going to lead to problems. So how do you find that proper balance?
So that is an excellent question, and it's really an excellent question. So research is clear when you look at the pattern, even though not many people will come out and say it, but research is clear that the first generation, so the refugees who come in, that's the first generation, will never become what we expect them, what we people who live here expect them to be. They are not going to speak English fluently. They will always struggle with English at some level. You know, I've worked with some people in my sample who have mastered English. They speak it. And some who are still struggling with it. So in that regard, they will, you know, not speak it well. In terms of religion, for example, many refugees, especially in their exile, they will not be excited to embrace the religion of the country. They will actually most likely go and become even more attached to their own religion. If they are even Christians, even. And I'm talking Muslim, Christian, Buddhist. I had them all in my sample. They become actually more attached to the religious community because that's where they find, you know, something that they can identify with. And they will most likely, that first generation, stay close and live in neighborhoods where other people, you know, they, you know, where other people from their country or their language or their religion live. But the great thing is, they do become, at least the people in my that I looked at and the research I looked at, they always know the law, they always become culturally more proficient, and they become, you know, more, they recognize and identify with the new country better. The second generation, however, so in the old days before the internet, it took all the way to the third generation for complete assimilation, where, you know, the person is, you know, so to speak, like you and me. They speak English without an accent. They are completely familiar with the country, with the organization. They identify with it. This is home to them. The other places they came from, it's just memory to them. They don't identify with it at all. Now, what I find interesting, again, when I looked at the research and I looked at the data and I looked at the people I'm working with, it's really interesting that the second generation, like their children, I mean, there is a couple of children from families I work with. One is from Bhutan, and one I worked with in the past from Pakistan. Even though the children grew up in the origin country, they identify as American. They speak English better than I do. There is no hint of accent. This is home to them. They identify with it. So that's good. But I think it's because of this information communication revolution. We have TV, internet, satellite TV. The second generation is becoming almost completely assimilated. They don't even identify with the foods, you know. I watched a video of one of the people in my sample the other day on Facebook. She posted it. And her family started a restaurant in Sandy. And she is trying to make a naan. Naan is bread. And she's trying to make Bhutanese naan. And she's filming herself making it. And she's like, I just can't do it. And she's making the dough and flipping it and putting it in and burning it and laughing at herself. And she's like, ugh, I guess I'll never learn how to do that. And I'm thinking, yeah, exactly, because you, at your age, I mean, she's just graduated community college. A true Bhutanese kid knows that at the age of 12, you know. That's a skill she doesn't identify with. And, you know, there are some questions she's asking her mom in the video, and I'm thinking, wow, she is, and her mom is mocking her. And so this second generation is just becoming Americanized. They are becoming, you know, like they've always lived and grew up here. She talks about high school. She talks about her prom. You know, the same thing with the Pakistani girl. Even though she's Muslim, she's wearing the hijab. You know, she talks about she went out to prom. She went out to a dance, and her dad let her, and her mom let her. So that's good. That's really excellent. But the first generation, the most important thing about them is to make sure that they are financially stable, that they have, you know, that they are received, that they have jobs, that they can support their families. Because research, especially in education, shows that if the family is poor or has problems finding work or finding jobs, that will hinder the integration process of the second generation. It will slow it down. But if the family is financially stable, in good position, they have housing, they have health care, they have education, access to education, then the second generation does very, very well. You know, you don't have school failure. Does that answer the question? Okay, great.
In Utah, how do refugees usually end up here? Like, it makes more sense when you're on the borders and everything, but, like, what's the process that people end up here?
So that's another great question. So there are states within the country that are determined to be good states for refugees, and I forgot the technical term. I apologize. But they are designated as refugee states. So Washington State is one of them, Arizona is one of them, Utah is one of them. and they are designated. Now, many refugees also go to places like Chicago. Minnesota, for example, is designated as a refugee state. And the people who end up there are mostly from Somalia and mostly the Karen of... they changed the name of the country a couple of times and I got lost. But it's a Southeast Asian country. I forget its name right now. Brain freeze. So they end up there in Minnesota. Sub-zero temperatures. There are so many factors that determine that. You know, for example, the population density of the state, availability of services, you know, availability of language resources. There is also something called voluntary resettlement organizations, Catholic Community Services, IRC, the LDS Church is one of them, Hebrew Immigration Assistance Services. So these communities have offices across the country. So their presence determines, you know, where to send them to. So, for example, if you're a Syrian refugee and you left Syria and you went to Jordan. In Jordan, you submit your asylum or refugee application through a Catholic charity. It's called Caritas. Caritas basically is what we call here Catholic Community Services. Now, Caritas becomes the holder of your file, and the preference is to send them to places where Caritas operates. So if they decide you need to go to the United States because the United States still has an unfilled quota, then they look at places in the United States where Caritas or Catholic Community Services exists, and they send you there. So Utah ended up, for example, with 26 refugee families, and it stopped since 2016 because the current administration doesn't allow anyone from the Middle East to come in as a refugee. But we ended up with 26 families because of that. If you're with Hebrew Immigration Aid Society, you know, their places of operation are Minnesota, Washington State, Arizona. So you end up in places that they have support for you. So this is one of the factors. And sometimes it's very random. Sometimes, yeah, the good thing is, so refugees who end up in Utah, I haven't talked to a single refugee who didn't like it. Actually, one of the Syrian refugees I worked with for my dissertation gave a speech the other day, and he said, I have a brother who was assigned to live in Chicago, and he keeps asking me to go there, and I told him there is no way I'm going to go live in Chicago. I love living in Utah. This is home to me. I love Utah, and I want to live in it until I die. So, yeah. So people in general love being in Utah. Yeah, especially people from the Middle East. This place, you know, the climate, the mountains, the deserts, you know, it's more Middle Eastern than you think. You know, it's really a great place for Middle Easterners to come. That's a great question, Celeste. Yeah, and the culture in Utah is very similar. You know, it's a very conservative culture, you know. It's a culture that focuses on the family, especially big families, and we really have great support. I mean, the Utah state government has been amazing, you know, responding to the refugee crisis. And I wish we get more refugees in Utah. I wish, because they end up being in society faster. Just observation, and this is not scientific. In my observation, refugees in Utah end up being included in the economy and social life faster than other places in the country. But this is my own limited observation. It's not scientific. Tina has a question.
So how did you end up in Utah? And what happened when you got here?
That is another great question. So as I said earlier, I'm a Palestinian. I grew up in Kuwait. And Kuwaiti law, when you are 18, or 17 actually, on your 17th birthday, you're not eligible to stay in the country with your family. You have to leave. So I graduated from high school at 17, and, you know, 17 and a half. And so once I graduated from high school, I had to leave. And so my dad decided, we're going to send you to Jordan to do your college degree. Because my father, one great thing that he did when he left Bethlehem, he passed by Jordan and applied for a Jordanian passport and got one. And so as a result, we became Jordanian citizens. Yeah, as a result of that. So when I graduated, I went to this place that I didn't know, Jordan. And I ended up, you know, living in a place where the son of one of my neighbors was a Mormon. And he was living in Utah, and he came one vacation and told me about the Mormon church, and I ended up becoming a Mormon. And so a few years after that, I got an opportunity to go and study at BYU. I came here and got my master's degree and then went back there and did some work for the church there in translation and interpretation. And then, you know, I went to Dubai to work because Jordan, you know, I lived in Jordan a total, in my life, I lived in Jordan a total of 7.5 years. That's it. So, and there is no work, no opportunity, especially if you're not a native Jordanian citizen. Remember, I said earlier, they put you where your father was born and your religion on your IDs. So if you're identified as Palestinians, the Jordanian population, even if you have a Jordanian citizenship, it's not very hospitable towards you getting work or good paying work. So I got an opportunity to go work in Dubai. And while working in Dubai, I met my wife, who was going to law school in Boston. And we ended up getting married, and she moved.
I know. I wasn't there.
Yeah.
Over the internet.
Yeah, we met. Yeah, we got set up. It was a Mormon setup. Via the internet. And I came to see her, fell in love, got married. And she went to live back with me in Dubai. But then September 11th happened. And the economic situation in Dubai became very, very bad. So we made a decision to come back to Utah. And I've always, you know, from my days at BYU in the early 90s, I just loved the place. I loved Utah. And actually, a part of my story is, you know, I wouldn't have made the decision to come to leave the Middle East. But having my wife and coming back here, I had difficulties finding work. I had difficulties actually getting a work permit to start with. Remember, this is post-September 11th. So I had problems finding work. And, you know, but having my wife's family and that kind of support was very helpful. You know, I was in a way sort of a refugee. I don't meet the technical definition of a refugee, but it felt like it. And that support was crucial, but then I found work, I met people, and I started my own business. And actually starting my own business helped me because I had to deal, it was teaching language, and I started teaching language to the government employees. And so I started traveling around the country, teaching classes, meeting all kinds of people. And my first job was actually at the call center. I was troubleshooting computers for people on the phone. And I managed to talk to like 50 people a day from all over the country. And so that was my own cultural immersion. You learn a lot from people. Once you get over the first 30 seconds to 2 minutes of abuse and being angry, once you calm them down and start talking to them, you start learning a lot. So that was a formative experience to me. And I learned a lot from it, and it influenced my thinking when I was working on my dissertation. It really did. I believe that once you put someone, work is the best way to make someone a part of a place. Because in a workplace, you learn rules, you learn to see people, you learn to negotiate situations, and it introduces you to the country and to the place better than anything, better than anything. If you want someone to become American, just throw them in an American workplace and work with them. That is the best thing for integration, that I can think of. That's my story in a nutshell. But I'm glad you asked the question. It brought up things I planned to talk about and I didn't. I'm sure.
It's a little long.
Well, mother tells a short version.
Oh, really?
Yes. She is essential to my being American and living here and considering this home. She is essential. I tell her, home is where she is, wherever she is. But she is a very important part of the story.
And I would say it's an ongoing story for sure. So I had left Utah. I had worked here. I worked for the state of Utah and decided to start law school and left and moved to Massachusetts. And within a few weeks of that, there were a few events that happened that were interesting. And one of those was a friend of mine here in Utah who had never attempted to set me up before, decided to. So I got a call one night, hey, can I give someone your email address? And, this was 2000. And so things like email were pretty well established, but there were chat rooms and just, some of that new stuff that at least I wasn't very sure about. And I said, okay. And I thought she just probably met someone from work, and she called me later that evening and said, so this Arab guy halfway around the world, and I was like, what? Why would you do that, So come to find out, she had a sister who had married a Jordanian and had lived in the Middle East, and her parents had gone to visit, and they had actually met Jabra several years earlier. And anyway, Jabra's sister randomly met someone from Sandy, Utah, and they did get married, and she moved here. And this friend of mine lived down the street from her, and they were sort of paired up together, and she kind of took his sister under her wing. And, in the Middle East, they're kind of used to marrying strangers. Parents sort of arrange things. I used to get a great kick out of reading the newspaper classifieds in Dubai because it was just pages and pages of proposal wanted ads. They were mostly from India, but it was it just cracked me up and disturbed me all at the same time. And so all of these people, Jabra's sister, my friend's parents, all these people converged in her home on this one Sunday night, and she sort of connected these dots and was hearing about this person and said, I'm going to connect him. I hear he's living in the wilderness and needs a wife, and so I'm going to give his sister my friend's email address. And he did send me an email, and in the first line, he debates this, but in the first line, it did say something about, so my sister, your friend, and long-term relationship. And I called my friend, and I said, not just any Arab guy, but a weird Arab guy, like, Now what do I do? And she just said, you need the practice. So engage. But it was definitely interesting. I think you can tell he's a very bright, compelling, genuine, kind, cheerful person. And so we had, in this new technological era, a great time just going through a list of about 75 things, topics that I had made a list of, because he said within a matter of like a couple of days, all right, that's it, you're the one, so whatever this takes, And I was like, you don't even know me. And so we spent a few months going through a list of topics and getting to know each other, and then he had several failed attempts to come and see me, which I wasn't sure what to make of that, but I did make the worst of it and come to find out he was just sort of a disorganized bachelor. And and I had some, I would say some really great, amazing spiritual experiences that also helped and along the way. And then he did come and meet with me, and we each had to take, I think, some big leaps of faith for each of us to kind of come together, but we did finally meet, and I withdrew from law school,
And he proposed within seconds of seeing me at the airport. We had already exchanged pictures, so anyway, and I said yes, and then immediately inside said no, what are you doing? So I became one of those people who said yes and then said no. And we drove back to Utah, packed up all my stuff, drove back to Utah, and roundabout Nebraska, you know, it was just this odd experience of, well, I'm totally comfortable with this person, and he's fascinating, and I really like him, and I don't know what this is, but I can't be engaged to you for now. And so he met my family. I met his sister here once we got back to Utah, and then he went back to Dubai, and a few months later, I said, okay, if, you know, maybe I can do this. And so we did. He came here. We got married in May of that year. And then it was just a few months later, as we were living in Dubai, that September 11th happened. And it was, you know, it put a whole new light on things as we walked out of our apartment door and saw Bin Laden construction across the street. And, you know, but there were great kindnesses. And it was a safe place to be, except for financially. So, you know, we have lots to be thankful for here, and he had a father who was dying of emphysema in Jordan, and we were sending every dime we had to get him care, and you have to prepay that kind of care, unlike you do here, and so we eventually had to flee, really, and we had to flee not because it was unsafe, but because your visa to be in the country was contingent on your employment. And when the when things started to heat up, all of the American and European countries pulled out of the United Arab Emirates. And his employer would have been able to have our passports and keep us there and yet not pay us. And that was a life and death kind of choice for his dad's health care. And so we had to leave the country quietly and quickly and make our way back here. And we did sort of start out. It definitely wasn't your typical refugee experience. We had lots of support, and I obviously have my own share of being an American and being, you know, in the middle class and all of those great things here. But we took my first paycheck, and we bought a 1981 Ford Fairmont, and that got us started, and, you know, the last 18 years have been an adventure, for sure. So,
thank you.
Can you just kind of explain what are the things that the LDS Church does for refugees? And do they do that internationally, or is it mainly in Salt Lake City?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, so when I was in the Middle East, when I was in Jordan, I was the Amman branch president, the Amman Jordan branch president for many years, and then I was a Jordan district president, and then I was assistant mission president for the Greece Athens mission. And I say that because when you're in those positions, a big part of your work at the time between 1991, remember we had the first Gulf War with Iraq. And as a result, Jordan received hundreds of thousands of Iraqi refugees. And so a huge part of my work was working with refugees there. And in the beginning, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints didn't have any response other than you go to the local bishop if you're a member, you ask for assistance like any member would. But then once we started talking about it, the church decided, okay, well, we need to do something to help refugees in the Middle East. And so starting in 1994, the church started sending, you know, they had this program where they sent medical equipment, space heaters, blankets, quilts, clothes, medicines, like by the container loads, to several refugee areas in Jordan. And then and it continued because we started working also with Syria, because Syria has many Palestinian refugee camps like Jordan does. So we started working with them. We started working with the Lebanese through the church branches in those countries. So that was the church response then. And currently, you know, and since then, since 1994, the church has expanded a lot. So in Jordan and Lebanon now, there is programs to provide aid, you know, in terms of food, medicine, space heaters, tents, all kinds of things to refugee camps there. Now, when refugees come here, just Utah, because I'm not aware if the church has anything to help refugees in other states, but here in Utah, the church response is incredible. For example, there is a ward in the 3300 South area, and that is where there is a huge concentration of refugees, but the church has this whole compound of buildings that basically refugees can stay there for 6 months to a year until they get established. And the local bishop's job, the bishop over that area, is very involved in the work with that ward. So he helps provide interpretation services for the children in their local school. He helps them with their, you know, finding work. He helps them with all kinds of aspects. And then Desert Industries has an amazing program for taking refugees in and sort of apprenticing them. So you go to DI, they start you in the back rooms, sorting through things. They work with you in your resume. You have a coach. You have several coaches who work with you. They provide you with language lessons. And so they help you start this, you know, getting to know what a paycheck is. Because, for example, most countries of the world, we're used here, your money arrives in your bank account, you know, you have to go to work, you have to check in. That experience isn't anywhere in the developing world. There you mostly receive your work in kind, or you receive it in cash at the end of the day. So even learning what a paycheck is and how to register your time is a huge thing for most refugees. So the church does lots of these things, and I'm familiar only with a very small part of what they do with refugees, because I know there are other aspects to it. But the parts that I'm familiar with are incredible. You know, the DI program, and then the work they do with refugees, like in the local wards. And here is the thing. So when I was doing my research, almost everyone in my research sample cited, because we asked them about the most important people in their lives, and almost everyone mentioned someone from a local ward. You know, if they didn't know the words ward or branch or any of that stuff, but they'd say, yeah, one of my Mormon neighbors, you know, came and helped me out with this. And the Bhutanese family I worked with, for example, their Mormon neighbor, they called him Grandpa. They loved him that much, and they wouldn't do anything like or make any financial decision without consulting with him. So the influence of the membership and the organization of the church is, I'd say, really huge. But it's here in Utah. Internationally, I know they help with refugee camps and financing, and we contribute money to different agencies globally. But I don't know if we have, like, refugee involvement in other states within the country. That's a great question. Questions, ideas? We have time. Or not. Or not. 20. Yeah.
Five more minutes.
Yeah. So any questions? Okay, one compelling story. Okay, so the most compelling story is of a Syrian who has five kids and his wife, and he was a chef in Syria. He worked throughout the Arab world, starting at age 14, you know, cooking and, you know, learning how to cook and working in the industry. In 2006, he decided it's time to go back to Syria. He had saved enough money, and he decided to open his own restaurant. So he opened his own restaurant. He was very happy with it, and then the Syrian war started. And unfortunately, in 2006, he got married, and he started having children, And one of the children, the first child, had like a host of health issues, including being autistic, having some genetic disorder, severely autistic with a genetic disorder and paraplegic. Then he had a second child who was the same. And then he had a third child, and he was okay. But then he had another child who had similar issues. So 3 out of his 5 children are paraplegic, autistic, and have some other disorder and it's all severe. And so when the Syrian war happened, when the bombs started falling, you know, first his restaurant was hit, then his house was hit, so he started moving within Syria from one place to another, and the situation kept getting worse. Now, 3 of his 5 kids need diapers, like some of them adult-sized diapers. And he just couldn't afford them, then he couldn't find them. And then transportation within Syria started becoming difficult, so he just couldn't move within the country anymore. It started either becoming difficult or impossible. Some areas of Syria, you know, you hear of ISIS and you hear of Nusra and all of these organizations, it just made movement inside Syria impossible. So he made a decision to go to Egypt. So he went to Egypt and started working in a restaurant there. But then, you know, he just couldn't make ends meet because, again, in the developing world, they take advantage of you if you're a refugee or a migrant. There is no labor laws to protect you. You don't get your pay, or you get your pay partially. So he tried going to work in Libya. All in the meantime, he had his application with UNHCR. And he was one of those cases because he has 3 children who are severely disabled. You know, he was one of their emergency cases. So remember I said 3 to 17 years. His thing happened in around, he got his refugee application approved within 3 years. And, you know, he was assigned to go to the United States because they decided the United States has the best, you know, care for his situation. And because the United States had a quota open, so he came here and he became a part of the Spice Kitchen program. And he's had a lot of challenges here, but it's been really great because, you know, his kids receive care that they wouldn't have received probably anywhere else. And he likes Utah a lot because, you know, it's compatible with his culture and with his beliefs, and he loves the people. And he always, whenever he talks about his experience, he says, "The people here are so friendly. I just love the people. You know, they always smile, you know, to you." So he continues to struggle. We're working with him to make his business stronger. You know, we organize refugee dinners for him to, you know, to introduce him to people and to help him get more business, which is another great way. You know, you can talk to me if you want, but there is what I do with a friend of mine who lives in Arizona is we organize refugee dinners. So we have a refugee cook for guests that you invite, and, you know, they pay for it, and then they donate to the family. So if you have an interest in doing that, let me know. But this is one great way to help. But he's, I'd say, despite of all of his difficulties, because I can't even imagine being in that situation. And I've been to his home several times, and I've seen his children, and it just breaks my heart. And it's very, very difficult. But despite of that, he thrives. He's building his business. He's just working 18-hour days almost every single day. He's just hustling and working all the time to a point where I think it's affecting his personal health a little bit. But he is a really great guy. Is that, I hope, this is just one example, and there are many, many stories like that out there. Richie.
Okay, let's give a warm thank you to Jabra.